Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. The last 2 weeks in January, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra had an extra full engagement calendar. Neighborhood concert, masterworks pair, new works visiting composers. And on the 31st, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Youth Orchestra's spring concert. Among the notables on hand was musician Michael Fine, a name to conjure with in the recording of classical music. And the recordings he has produced have won just about every major award in the classical recording industry. Mr. Fine, however, was here as a composer, and in the intimate neighborhood concert January the 21st, one of the works was Michael Fine's Suite for Strings, and this music is from the overture. I was very fortunate to catch him with time to spare earlier in the week of the 18th when we recorded the following conversation. Your name recognition for most people, as I understand it, is the quality of the recordings you make.
That's very kind. I didn't know I had any name recognition.
Yes, that you have acquired considerable reputation for making
Very possibly.
Especially good. And talking to Philip when he was telling me this, I was sort of trying to think how that could happen.
The real training that I got for recording was growing up with my grandfather from Nizhny Novgorod. And even as a young child, we listened to recordings in a very intense and intelligent way. And Grandpa would always tell me to listen inside the music. And the one skill you really need as a recording producer is the ability to listen. And to listen objectively. We also say in our business that we don't make any friends because most of our work is telling people that was bad, play it again, this was terrible, try it again. I try to do it in a nicer way than that over the years. But in a sense, even with the greatest artists and the best equipment and the best of intentions, there's no guarantee what will happen. I like recording in a funny way because of the falseness of it. Music is really not meant to be talked about or recorded. It's meant to happen in time to be a memory that can be fleeting or that lingers. And it's like the Keats Grecian urn. On the other hand, every time we listen to a recording, we hear new things. We discover new things. We have the opportunity of rediscovery, like looking at a painting. So when I go to the National Gallery in London, I always gravitate to the same rooms. I look at the same paintings. I've seen them for, well, not to give away so much of my age, but for 45, 50 years. And they change as I change and grow. The art of rereading, which is a great joy, of course. So in that sense, I don't feel quite so guilty about recordings. But a recording is not a concert performance. A recording is the idealized embodiment of what is in the performer's mind. And to a certain extent, with all due respect, what is in my mind, because I do have a certain measure of control in the mixing and the balancing of the orchestra and the cording. It's a lot of fun, I have to say. I enjoy the process. Most conductors don't like the process, but they realize that there's nothing better for a symphony orchestra than to record with this sort of mean man with a voice coming over a box saying, well, you know, we need to do that again. There's a movie that was made, it's called Para Caminar, and I'm the bad guy in the movie, but all you see of me is my finger hovering over a talkback button to stop the orchestra and when that moment will come. The movie makers apologized for that, but it is true. But I'm conducting in Mexico in 2 weeks, Guanajuato. So why was I hired? I'm not a conductor. I'm a recording producer. They said they wanted to have a recording session from the podium. They wanted to hear the things that I would say in a recording session.
When we said that, you know, there's that lovely from the Rubaiyat of Omakayam. The moving finger writes and
yes,
having
indeed.
Grit moves on.
Indeed. And unfortunately, the moving finger moved quite frequently in that particular recording session.
But getting back to the seeds of what you found that led from your grandfather on into this particular career that's followed you, when you were old enough to realize the importance of listening to the way the music itself speaks to you. When were you aware of that as being so really important, other than just hearing the music? But what sort of music did you start with?
This is rather embarrassing, but even as a child, I wanted to stop concerts. Suggest that perhaps that passage could be done better. I've gotten over that. I'm now able to listen to a concert and accept the occasional flaws. I really do like hearing the score reproduced accurately and in detail and beautifully. Listening is a, I don't want to say it's a lost art, but listening to, for example, different languages, the music of the languages, listening to, you know, what is a musical phrase? Is the phrase finished? It's me being a contrarian, a naysayer when someone thinks that was beautiful. And I think, yeah, it was beautiful, but this note could have vibrated a bit more and that note is not precisely in tune. I work with a wonderful French violinist, Bruno Capuçon. We make a lot of recordings together. And he always says, Michael, sometimes I want to kill you, but I know that if you didn't do this and I heard the recording, I would be very angry. Not angry, but upset. Because if I can make it better and I don't do it, if I don't stop the orchestra or the soloist or the singer, I haven't done my job. I tell you one story, a very famous Russian soprano. We did a recording of Rachmaninoff songs in Germany. And there was one particular high note that was consistently flat, and I stopped her and I said, I'm really sorry, but we do need to get this a little better if possible. I can help in the post-production. And her husband, who was with me in the booth, grabbed the microphone and said, no, it's perfect, it's genial, it's genius. Why is this man torturing you? And I said, okay, that's how you feel about it. So I made the recording with this note being microtonally flat. And she called me up and she said, why are you putting a recording out with a take that makes me sound bad? And I said, do you remember the session? And I said, you know what? Why don't you come and listen to the session material? And I had a studio then in Lüneburg in Germany, just a place where Mr. Bach used to live, north near Hamburg. And she came with her husband, and she listened, and she heard the exchange. And I'm very sorry to say they got divorced.
Over that.
Well, there are probably other issues as well that I wasn't aware of. But, I mean, it's a job where you need to be brutally honest, no matter who it is. And somehow when you get into this recording producer zone, it's you and the score in front of you, and everything goes away. And it doesn't matter whether, I'm remembering a time recording with Pierre Boulez in Cleveland, Mahler 4, late dear Pierre, and in the place, I said, I'm really sorry to stop, but this has never been together. We need to do this again. And then sometimes artists will ask you really for tips. How should I finger this? How should I play it? How should I phrase it? And you need to be flexible. You need to give them back what they need. My job, it's not about my taste in music. I've recorded many artists whose taste I don't agree with. My job is to give them back their idealized view of the music. I'm just simply the audience. And I would never, ever edit or post-produce anything that would be in contradiction to the artist's view of the music, whether I particularly cared for it or not. It's not about me. It's very much, it's a behind-the-scenes role. But at the same time, I like the role to be recognized, not just for me, but for my colleagues, because we do play a major part in what makes a recording good or less good. We want to make it good. We always want to make it better. In fact, for me, if it sounds better in the room than it does in the booth, then I'm not doing my job correctly. Mm. So
going way, way back then, You've got this thing instilled in you to listen and to hear what you're listening for and to find it. Did you at the same time start playing your own instruments and playing with them in a way that made you realize that an instrument was not the same as a voice, was not the same as somebody playing the instrument?
Well, I'm a clarinetist. I'm largely self-taught, and I would play along with Benny Goodman records. So, yes, I definitely had that experience. And actually, last summer, I sang in a jazz concert in the Festival Mosaic and played clarinet in San Luis Obispo. So I got the singing experience, and I also sang in some opera workshop productions a long time ago. But I'm, well, my wife might say an idiot savant, but I'm completely self-taught. I had the great privilege of studying geology and English literature at the university because I wanted to study things that I was not, that didn't come to me as easily. And easily is not the right word. That sounds arrogant. Music was more natural, more native to me than science, for example. So I thought, this is a good opportunity to learn something that I would not simply intuit. And I mean, to be honest with you, as a clarinet player, if I'd been better trained, I'd be a better player. I never studied recording production, certainly never studied composition, and never studied conducting.
Did you ever play in a band, as kids do?
I also played in a German beer hall band for a few extra pennies and
a forbidden
taste of beer at 14. But yeah, I've done a lot of...
Then the jazz and the what might have seemed like cacophony of some music as it was being created and experimented with, did you have that same feeling of you needed to get in and do some tweaking?
I'm always tweaking and fixing and trying to make it more beautiful somehow, because I do have a certain aesthetic of sound and music that is very important to me. Sometimes it is antithetical to what my artists want, but we try to find a good rapprochement, a good conclusion. But I remember very distinctly when I was a very young boy and I first heard the Stravinsky, the Sock, the Rite of Spring, and I told my grandfather, and he was very, very upset. And he said, this is not music. And then he said, there is no more music. And those were perhaps the saddest words I heard as a child. And Grandpa didn't live too much longer after that. But my tastes were certainly more eclectic when I was younger, but I keep making musical discoveries. I always ask kids, what are you listening to? So I did a recording with a pianist who I believe is played, her name Norman Krieger. And Norman brought his daughter, Jacqueline, to a recording session in Berlin. And I just said, so what are you listening to? I need to know. And she gave me some names of some artists. And I'm always curious. I mean, thank God for curiosity. That's what keeps us going, I think. So yeah, I'm always, and now with Apple Music and these curated playlists, I'm just trying so many things. Just, I mean, it's, there's so many horizons to explore. It never ends.
Going back to your deciding to take science and various other non-familiar subjects, did you find music in rocks and stones and things like that?
The geology thing actually came from a line in Shakespeare's Sermons in Stone, Duke Senior. And the idea that somehow the stones could tell us something about ourselves, that's kind of almost embarrassing, so nerdy, as they would say, for a teenager to get that, but that's where it came from. Yeah, there's music in everything, and sometimes I think my favorite music is birdsong. I walked with my wife the last segment of the Camino to Santiago. She's in remission from cancer, and we decided to celebrate, and the constant accompaniment of birdsong was the most beautiful music I've ever heard. I think silence is also incredibly beautiful. Yeah, music is inescapable and includes the silence.
My guest is musician Michael Fine, renowned for the many award-winning classical music recordings he has produced, and whose life embraces so much else in music.
But recording is imperfection by its nature. Maybe that's what I like about it.
So the singer with a flat note is more honest.
I'm going to fix it because that's my job. And because if it happened in a concert, it would go by. It might be noticed by some, but in a recording, which hopefully is listened to more than once, it would get rather irritating, I would think.
What about choirs? Choirs?
Pleasure. I mean, choirs there's some basic rules. The tenors are generally going to be weaker if they're an amateur choir. I've recorded great choirs like the Swedish Radio, which is one of the best in the world, the Brahms Requiem with Valery Gergiev for the Beast label. And The Korean choirs are spectacular.
Oh, why is that?
Well, they sing from the earliest age. If you go to a Korean party, you will be asked to sing at some point. They're some of the most musical people that I've ever encountered. And I recorded the Beethoven Ninth, Mahler's Second, with the Seoul Philharmonic and Myung-hun Chung. And my colleague, a German tonemeister, Wolf-Dieter Karbatki, whose first recording was Wilhelm Kempf, said that the Seoul Philharmonic's choir was better than a German choir. And we did Nevsky there, and the Russian mezzo-soprano said they're better than the Mariinsky choir. It's simply an inherent musicality, an ability to sing, a good sense of mimicking languages, which is also very important.
Kodály was one of these who pushed singing.
Yeah.
And singing anything together and getting to know what they were singing and how they were singing it, so that singing was so natural to them, speaking and the things that they had to do to communicate became easier, was the implication.
Singing is maybe more natural than speaking. I mean, that may sound rather strange and even eccentric, but I believe it's true. I also remember when I was a young boy, I walked into the kindergarten class singing, and the teacher looked at me and said, "Well, you can't do that." And I said, "But I always sing at home." That was an important social lesson, I guess. But yes, singing is perhaps the most natural thing that any of us do. And even when people are out working, they start to sing. I was in the army. We sang. We sang on marches. We sang in the tanks. I mean, it seemed to be something so natural to mm-hmm. all of us. And I realize there are certain social compunctions that one doesn't break out into song. But you go to a bar in Ireland and we're passing around the Guinness, and there's a lot of singing going on. And it's all, I mean, I can't judge the quality at that point in my inebriation state. But there's nothing more natural than singing. It's all about singing. We play musical instruments. We are singing.
And though you were saying listening to the silence is something in the silence, there's never complete silence, there are those who wickedly imprison people and deliberately block the sound of silence.
And that's the worst torture.
Yes.
I think. And it always astonishes me that there's such a great degree of cruelty in the world. And we don't know how we would react in that circumstance, but somehow maybe we would try to take the noise they're forcing on us and make it into some sort of internal music. None of us know how we would deal with it. Sadly, there are people that have dealt with it. But silence is a great treasure. And silence, only if you know silence can you understand music. I worked for a while with the choreographer, Merce Cunningham, in New York. And Merce always talked about the space between the dancers as being just as interesting as what the dancers were doing. And I always said, "Merce, you're really a musician. You're talking about silence." But yeah.
So there's a language of appreciation of the actualities rather than of sound and speech.
You know, interesting, in the recording, I spend a lot of time, I can't speak for my colleagues, in the silence between pieces, the quality of the silence, the length of the silence. Sometimes we actually borrow room ambience from other halls and insert them in recordings made in a different hall just because we like the quality of the silence. I remember once when you wear headphones, as you do, and you have them cranked very high to hear the silence, you're shouting to each other because, and I remember my wife and my colleague, Wolf Dieter's wife, saying, what are they talking about? And we were talking about the silence, but we were shouting at each other because we had the headphones on and we were speaking and at very high levels to hear the quality of the silence. Very important.
Yes. And as you say, the length of the silence is almost always the right length.
Very hard to predict because it also depends how you listen. If you're listening with great intensity and care, the silence will be the correct number of seconds. Perception of time. When my grandfather and I would listen to music, you know, we would sit in very uncomfortable chairs, quite ramrod straight, and we would listen. I don't think too many people put a recording on now and sit down with folded hands and listen. It's background. a little bit, which is disappointing. And that also means the experience of the silence tends to be shorter.
Mm-hmm. And something interrupts it too.
Yeah.
So when you're composing, because we're going to be listening to your suite for strings, have you found that instinctively these moments we've just talked about, the silence, the breath, the where you've written a phrase, when it repeats itself, it will be different perhaps from what it started with, and it would be that because of the silence or the speed with which...
Perception of time is very important. Wayne Shorter said that composing is improvising but slower. I only began to compose a few years ago. I was on a broken down train in Dordrecht in the Netherlands. My portable digital devices, as they call them on the airlines, were out of battery, and I was going to be stuck for a very long time. We were on a bridge. There was no chance to get off. And in my backpack, I had some score paper, and I started to write a piece. And it was actually quite enjoyable. It was also a bit therapeutic. My wife had just been diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a rather unpleasant cancer, and I just needed something to take my mind away. And I wrote this piece. It was premiered last year. And so I'm a baby composer. I don't have a system like many composers. I start and I stop when I'm finished. And I was very reluctant in my early pieces. This is the first piece I wrote for orchestras this week, for strings, to linger. I'm trying to linger more now, and I'm not afraid of repetition, but I want to avoid simple note spinning, which is actually very easy to do. So for reasons I don't understand, over the past 3 years, I've written a lot of music, and I was quite honored and touched when Le Chant du Monde, the great French publisher, said they would like to, would I entrust my music to them? And I said, yes. And the Suite for Strings is the first thing they published. It's baby writing as a composer. It's not terribly innovative, but I hope it's pleasant. It's not offensive. The idea started with a tune that you hear in the cellos in the first movement, the overture. The second movement, I was noodling on a piano in Korea, having just heard the Sibelius Second. It's kind of Nordic. And then I thought, well, it's awfully chilly up here. Let's go south. And I did a movement called, I think one's called Looking North or Heading North. The other's called Heading South or Looking South. And then the end, simply finding home. And we find home in a very, very basic C major kind of way. I think it tells a nice story. I'm not breaking new ground. And it was really, in many ways, a learning piece. But for me, the important thing is, I think for every composer, hearing the music rehearsed and performed is the test, is the workshop. There's something in your mind. And I will also tell you that composing uses a completely different part of the brain than everything else I do in music. So I make mistakes as a composer that I would catch as a recording producer. Now, happily, I haven't produced any of my own pieces, so I haven't been able to chastise myself publicly. It comes from a different impulse. It's something you have to say. And when my piece was premiered in California last summer, the flute piece, the one written on the broken down train, I thought I would, when I went to the rehearsal, I would just keep my mouth shut and let them play it as they wanted to. And then I thought, no, actually, I want it to be this way. And you do have a sense of ownership, but also a sense of giving it over to the artist. And I will say, thankfully, that good musicians save bad composers, because a good musician will always try to make whatever I write or anyone writes sound musical, even if it is inherently not musical. I also try to write music that's playable. Although, on the other hand, it was Renaud Capucine who said, you know, Michael, because I'm writing a violin concerto, put in some challenges. It makes us, you know, makes us feel better. Don't make it so playable. And I can write impossible things too. But all the activities I do, they help. So now, as a composer, when I look at a score as a recording producer, I look at the score completely differently. Mm-hmm. I've played in orchestras. I conduct orchestras occasionally. All these things and producing recordings, they all fit together to make a whole picture of the music world that I have inhabited now for, well, for a very long time.
Yes, and learned something new probably.
Still
every
learning,
time.
Making breakthroughs. I have a friend, a pianist named Susan Kagan. She's 85 years old, maybe. I shouldn't give away the age, but she played the American premiere of the Messiaen Quartet for the End of Time. And we did a recording when she was 80, and it was fantastic. And her husband said, yeah, she's just making so many breakthroughs still. You're never finished as a musician, as a listener. There's always that breakthrough, that new light bulb going off in your head, that new gleam of understanding of something that you've struggled with your whole life, and all of a sudden now you understand it, you can play it, you can listen to it, you comprehend it.
It never stops.
It never stops. And, you know, I always think that my last breath, hopefully there'll be some breakthrough that I understand something I've never understood before. Music or anything, frankly.
Well, there has to be somebody there to understand it when you tell them.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I was thinking also with all that you've been working with other people's compositions, how much of it is in your mind and how many of the things you have heard, you have somehow instinctively altered them.
Well,
and some of them are coming back as your pieces.
The opening of the second movement of the Suite for Strings is definitely Scandinavian, Sibelian, Nordic. It was what I heard the night before. And musicians, we're all sponges. I mean, if I hear a great concert, it will definitely influence me when I practice the clarinet the next day, because I will instinctively have taken, hopefully, good things from what I've heard. It may fade after a few days. But
well, you've absorbed it, and maybe it doesn't come up again until sometime later, and then
and that's
sudden,
fine.
Yes,
I mean, our speech comes from an accumulation of things we've absorbed over time. I mean, it's funny when a literary reference comes to mind. It may be something you haven't thought about for many, many years, but it suits the moment. And sometimes when you're writing music and you've got a number of measures written and the rest of the page is blank, that can be quite daunting for some people. And at that moment, that phrase that you need comes. And then afterwards you might think, oh, you know, really that comes from X. That's a bit from a Mahler harmonic change or something else, but you make it your own. There's something called plagiarism, but for example, what did Brahms say about the theme of the First Symphony? Someone said, it sounds like Beethoven 9th. They said, any fool can see that. We don't live in a musical vacuum. And in many ways, it's the beauty of our work that we're constantly enlarging upon what came before us. Whether we actually make a real contribution through that that's for somebody else to decide, not for me. I don't think I write music for the ages. I do it because I want to do it and I like doing it. And there seem to be a few people who like it as well. But the idea of enlarging upon what has come before is a very potent idea. For people far greater than me, of course, but in every field, in literature and science, life, philosophy, music, art, none of us exist in a vacuum. Filling in the empty spaces is a very interesting philosophy of life. I hadn't thought of it before like that, but that's very good, I think.
That was Michael Fine, composer, conductor, tops in his field of classical recording producers, who was in Little Rock the week of January the 18th to hear the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Intimate Neighborhood Concert, January the 21st, which included his work, Suite for Strings. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.